I've been giving talks during one-day sittings at the end of the day, and part of the reason was that it seemed that it was a huge interruption in the day to first have lunch and then to have a talk, because for you all, it's often listening to a talk is just a continuation of your break rather than a time where you continue with the practice. So it's a long chunk then of time where... So it seems to work well at the end of the day, but today I wanted to do it early on because I want to talk about the five hindrances. And five hindrances are a very important topic for people who do meditation practice and people who try to bring mindfulness into their life. And I thought if I talked about it at the beginning, in the middle, then it's still relevant for the rest of the day. Because I'm sure that some of you will be visited by the hindrances as we keep sitting here. And as some of you know, it's a very important topic, and it's important because it's a very common phenomena in meditation practice. And one of the reasons why it's a nice... one of the things I like about talking about it is people who are relatively new find it so often a relief to hear about them, because suddenly they realize, oh, this is kind of what's supposed to happen, rather than, oh, what's wrong with me? I'm the only one here who's lost in anger, or I'm the only one here who's restless, or the only one here is full of doubt of what's going on. But these five hindrances are five phenomena which the human mind, the human heart, seems to create quite readily. And it's very important to become aware of them because their function or their nature is to get us kind of entrapped in them or lost in them. So when they become very strong, these things, they hinder the free flow of awareness. They hinder the free flow of our life energy. And so we get sucked into them, and we don't even necessarily know that we're lost in them. But you spend, you know, how many, you know, minutes, hours do we spend lost in some kind of wonderful, delightful fantasy? And don't even know that we're in a fantasy, we're just kind of lost in the delight. Or we're just kind of, the energy of anger is so strong, we're kind of addicted to it, and we're lost in our anger before we even, for hours, before we even kind of fully, completely, honestly recognize that we're angry. And, you know, so it might happen much, much quicker with the recognition in the sitting practice, but still these are the kind of, I call the black holes of awareness, the places where the light of awareness goes in, but because of the gravitational force is so strong, the light doesn't come out, the awareness doesn't come out, there's no self-awareness. And so these are important topics to realize that it's part of the territory, part of the realm of what we're trying to become aware of and need to become aware of. And a lot of what practice is about, in a sense, is understanding the hindrances well enough so the hindering quality of them, the hindering quality of these five things of strong sensual desire, desire for sensual gratification, strong ill will, aversion, sloth and torpor, tiredness, restlessness, worry, and anxiety, and the fifth is doubt. So become aware of them enough so that they don't become hindrances. So what would it be like to have sensual desire and it's not a hindrance? So you're not caught by it, we're not enslaved by it, we're not acting compulsively on it. So that's the idea, is not necessarily to make enemies of these things, but to pull ourselves out of them enough so that we're not hindered by them in our life. Now, in kind of in shorthand, it's somewhat very simplistic, but in shorthand, you could say that the five hindrances are five strategies or responses that we come up with when things are difficult for us, when there's when we don't like what's going on, for example. One of the first four appeared. So the first one is one response is if you don't like what's going on, you could want something that's better, that's more satisfying, more sensually satisfying. If you don't like the weather, then you can spend the day thinking about Mazatlan, you know, and that's considered to be being lost in the hindrance of sensual desire, thinking about the wonderful beach in Mazatlan and the warm weather and how soothing it is and everything. And now now you can spend the rest of the afternoon thinking about that, I guess, if I bring it up like that. But anyway, so to be lost, one response when we don't like something, when things are difficult, when things are challenging to us, is to imagine or get lost in fantasies or ideas and strategies about how to make things much more pleasant and nice and for us ourselves. The other strategy, kind of the opposite of that, is to lash out at the difficulty, to push it away, to have aversion to it, to have ill will, resentment, anger, you know, all these kind of all kinds of negative approaches, trying to push it away or not deal with it. So the in both of these, in both desire and aversion, there's an object to our attention, and we're living in kind of a dualistic world where there's an object and us in relationship to the object. And one direction is to want it or want something, and the other is to want to avoid it and push it away. The third strategy, sloth and torpor, is we get discouraged. When things are very difficult, we get discouraged or depressed about what's going on. That's one strategy. It's a strategy that that I remember I had when I was a kid. I didn't like what my parents, you know, wanted me to do, or they wouldn't let me do what I wanted to do, and I became kind of a sourpuss, and I would go and mope around the house and quickly dejected and depressed. And it was a strategy of responding when things don't go my way. The other way is the kind of the opposite of this, is to get restless and anxious and get lost in the excitement or the energy of restlessness and not being able to sit still and not being able to be patient and present for anything, and kind of running all over the place. And the fifth strategy is the strategy of doubt. Things are difficult, and so we respond with doubt. We doubt the thing, we doubt the appropriateness, we doubt ourselves, our ability to handle it or be doing it, we doubt the people we're with, we doubt, you name it, and we can doubt it. And doubt, we can get lost in this world of doubt. And doubt is considered to be the most seductive of the five hindrances, because it has a voice sometimes that sounds very believable or compulsive, or it feeds into our insecurities. And so we want to make decisions based on doubt, or we don't want to kind of follow through on our decisions. We hold ourselves back. One way to feel and notice doubt is that it's characterized by kind of holding back in practice. It's what holds us back sometimes. So these are five strategies that we have when things get difficult. So learning to recognize these strategies is part of the way then we can start becoming free. And the very important things happening, the very important phenomena, mental movements in meditation. And it's considered in the Buddhist tradition that once the hindering quality of these five different states has dissipated, that then there's no real obstacle anymore for allowing you to settle very deeply and intimately on the present moment. That these are the most powerful forces that keep us from being present. And in that sense, they're fragmenting forces. They tend to fragment us. And I think we all have the experience of what it's like to be fragmented in our life. Many of us, if you come and sit on retreat or sit just daily at home, especially in the afternoon, you feel the fragmented body. You feel the body and the mind and the emotions are all kind of in different places. And part of what happens in sitting is the body and the mind and the heart and the emotions get unified. They come together and get settled together. And the hindrances fragment us. They fragment us from our ability to be complete and whole in ourselves. What part of us is running off into Mazatlan, the other part is running off for the, running off for the earplugs to plug in the ears and try to avoid the external difficulty that might be coming your way, or turning on the television to numb out the difficulty. Rather than feeling fully what's really going on, rather than feeling fully the difficulty, a thing that we're being challenged with in the present moment. The hindrances are very important in meditation, but they're also very important, I believe, in our normal life. And they're kind of a useful frame for looking at what goes on in our daily life. And I read a little article recently by Sylvia Borstein's husband. Sylvia is a Vipassana teacher, and her husband is a therapist. And he wrote an article using the five hindrances as a frame or as a reference, as a way of understanding the difficulties couples have in relationships to each other. And so he analyzed relationships, the difficulties of how desire causes problems, and how aversion, and how restlessness, and how sloth and torpor, and how doubt comes into play. So I think it's really useful to look at different areas of our life as a way of clarifying some of the inner movements. So the first one is sensual, the literal word is sensual desire. And what's being addressed here is not sensuality itself, it's not having sensual experiences, but rather the drive, the compulsiveness drive for gratification of the sensual experiences, of our sensuality. In some religious traditions, our sense experience, our sensuality, is considered to be off limits. It's kind of taboo. It's not really spiritually to be experience our sensuality in a sense. But the Buddha, he didn't say that. Rather, the Buddha was offering a practice which was to open all the sense doors, to be really open to our sensuality and feel it and make it alive. Because the fullness of our being comes through the senses. Life in the present moment is a series of contacts. It's a series of contact with the world around us. Physical contact, contact with the eyes, with the ears, contact with our mind and awareness of our thinking. That in order to be in the present moment is made up of a long series of constant contacts. To lose contact with the present moment is to lose that intimate, tangible contact with what's actually going on. To be lost in fantasies of sensual gratification is to be lost in a virtual world. That has very little to do with real contact. And what we're doing in mindfulness is dropping into the world of contact and what arises directly out of contact, the feelings, the sensations, and the perceptions that arise from contact itself. So stay in touch with contact. And a lot of that, you know, that's very much of that is sensual contact. So the Buddha wasn't saying, you know, shut off your sensuality. I would argue the opposite. He was saying, open it up. What is it like if you really open up really wide to become, to really feel, to sense? One Vipassana teacher described Vipassana practice as being radical permission to feel. Oh, that was nice. So what's that like? And if you do that thoroughly, if you give yourself permission to feel, to open to the sense doors and experience everything, then you can become aware of the difference between simply having it open, the sense doors, and feeling your sensuality, feeling contact with the wind against your cheeks, or whatever, the taste of the food, or whatever it might be. The difference between that and then being compulsively driven for gratification, to be enslaved in a sense for, oh, you know, I need to have just the right kind of chocolate, and they don't seem to have it at the local store, so I better drive all over Palo Alto until I find, you know, the right thing. That's being driven by it. And what happens in meditation is we can see very carefully the difference between simply being open to the senses and experiencing them and being caught in the virtual world, the thought world, the fantasy world of our ideas and thoughts about getting gratified and pursuing it. So we see it often, you know, very simply. One is you know, we don't feel like we have exactly the right cushion. So we spend, you know, hours here on the cushion designing and dreaming about what exactly the right cushion should be, and it should be filled with water like a waterbed, and, you know, and, you know, and the kind of velvet cover it should have, and, you know, how wonderful it would be to feel, you know, to sit on that, and maybe you should be able to heater on it and keep yourself warm. And you know, maybe it can be kind of adjustable, the amount of pressure in it, something that as the day goes along, you can kind of reduce the pressure, they kind of make it a little softer. And you're lost in this kind of world of gratification, making things really comfortable and soothing and nice. And in the meantime, you have no idea what's going on in the present moment. You're lost into that world. And part of the danger with the hindrance of sensual desire is that sensual desire, sensual thoughts about sensual gratification are compulsive, they're addicting, they're enchanting. They're often quite wonderful, and we get enchanted by it, and off we go, exploring it. And when we do that, we fragment ourselves because we're in the world of, I like this word, virtual world. And we've lost contact with the real world. We lost contact with the present moment, lost contact with what's actually going on in the present moment because we're lost in that world. to open our sense doors is actually a way of getting having energy. There's a lot of energy to have all the sense doors open. To close down the sense doors, to feel this particular sense door is not appropriate or is not acceptable, is actually kind of deadening for our life. So the movement of mindfulness is to enliven our felt sense life rather than to deaden it, to open everything. And the other one, the opposite then, is the aversion. And aversion also can be very compulsive, feelings of ill will, anger, hostility toward what's going on. Because if there's enough energy there, the energy itself is addicting. The energy itself gets swept up in the energy of anger. And it's no longer, we don't even know what we're doing, but the energy is really enlivening, and we're addicted to that sense of energy that comes from anger, from ill will. But we don't like what's going on. And so rather than simply being open, staying open to the unpleasantness of it, and finding some kind of satisfaction and some kind of wholeness in being open to it, we fragment ourselves by shutting off that, saying, pushing that away, saying, this is not acceptable, and I'm going to push that away, I'm going to have aversion to it, I'm going to criticize it, I'm going to find everything that's wrong with it, I'm going to be bored with it. We hold it off and hold it at a distance. And so rather than fantasizing and dreaming about the perfect meditation cushion, you start thinking about this terrible cushion you have. And you can't wait till you get home because you're going to burn it. And it doesn't even deserve that good of a fate. And you're going to just figure out exactly you're going to bury it. So you have thoughts of aversion or ill will, and you get lost in this world of treating it as an object and keeping it separate and pushing it away. And again, I think it's fragments as it shuts off, it turns away, rather than being open to experience something fully, to be in contact with what's going on. And sometimes that can be quite deadening, because often then it takes the form sometimes of resentment, of feeling it over and over and over again, holding onto it. And the resentment closes ourselves down from really feeling openly the full root cause of what's actually going on. If we perceive that something is unpleasant, to go into that, to be open to it, and then go in and understand that fully, is the movement of mindfulness. Why is it we don't like this phenomena? Why is it there's negativity? Maybe it's unpleasant in and of itself. The knee hurts and it's unpleasant, so we're open to that. But there are other experiences which, say for example, you're sitting here following your breath, and the breath, you're simply not able to stay with it very well, and the breath doesn't feel as smooth and as wonderful as it did at another retreat. And you're not so satisfied, you don't feel so settled, and you're kind of upset about it, and it's unpleasant, and then you start thinking, well, I really hate this breath of mine, and why do I have to do breath meditation, and maybe I should try to find some way to hold my breath, or maybe I should do this or that, or maybe the problem is that it's cloudy today, and I can't stand the cloudiness, and maybe the whole retreat is wrong, on and on it goes, the world we've lost in the world of aversion. But to investigate that, to connect with it and see what's actually going on there. And it isn't simply that there's an unpleasant sensation, but rather what's the genesis of it is this idea that in order to have a good meditation, you have to be able to have a smooth, full breath that you're connected with nonstop. So there's an evaluation, a judgment. And based on that judgment, there's a feeling, oh, this is something wrong here, there's some unpleasantness here. And out of that then comes all this reactivity. So to open up towards it and understand it, rather than get lost in perpetuating the aversion. With both the pursuit of sensual gratification and the pursuit of ill will and aversion, a very powerful way of practicing with this in mindfulness practice is to feel it in your body. Feel it. We feel it carefully. Where do we feel it in our body, the desire? Where do we feel the aversion? It isn't actually, it's only in our imagination that we think it's a virtual world, because we get lost in the thoughts and the stories. But actually, it occurs also in our body. It manifests in the body. So ill will, you feel kind of a clenching, a tightening perhaps, or pulling away, or you feel like a heat that comes up, or you feel something in the body. Desire, you feel another thing in the body. It's very different. Rather than feeling tightened, if it's a wonderful daydream about the beaches of Mazatlan, maybe you feel kind of relaxed and open and calm. It's one of the reasons why sensual gratification, thoughts of it, can be seductive, because they can actually be calming and soothing. And many of us are desperate for that. That's our attachment. We want to be calmed and soothed rather than to be awake and aware. So to feel it in the body, sense it, what's going on in the body, is part of what we do in mindfulness. And then there's what's classically called sloth and torpor. And this is in part sometimes has to do with discouragement, sometimes kind of depressiveness, you know, that we don't like what's going on, we're troubled by it, we're confused by it, and so we shut down, we deaden ourselves, we give up. The mind kind of becomes dull, heavy, cloudy. You can't seem to bring your awareness, you can't seem to use your awareness, everything seems so heavy. It's more than just physical tiredness, it's kind of a closing down of the system. And why is that? Well, we don't know, but what we do in mindfulness is we sense it and feel it fully. To all the hindrances, we don't take them to be problems, to be fixed. We don't take them as requiring action to change something. What we do is we simply bring awareness to them fully and completely. Oh, this is what's going on. And allow it to be there. So you bring awareness to sloth and torpor. And how do you feel the tiredness, the dullness in the body? Do you feel it mostly in your head, in the eyes, in your chest, in your shoulders? Where do you feel it? Investigate it and be with it. What's going on? What is there? Is it resistance? Is it arising because of resistance? Do you feel there's a resistance somewhere in your body, somewhere in your mind? Oh, not this, not again. And you feel the drop of energy because, oh, not again. To feel that, and to feel the drop of energy, what does that feel like? Where does the energy go? What does it feel like to have a lack of energy in the body? What does that feel? Explore it, sense it. It's a sensory awareness exercise. So you feel it and sense it. Sloth and torpor. And then there's being restless. The classic phrasing of it is restlessness and anxiety. And it often has to do with what arises out of worry and being anxious. We get full of energy, full of excitement. We don't know which way to go. We're kind of like running around like a chicken without a head. Because we're kind of confused, perhaps, and there's all this energy here, and it's undirected, it's uncentered. We don't like what's going on, but we don't have any other options, and we can't go forward, we can't go back, we're confused. And many, many different ways of feeling the restlessness that might arise. It's often said that it comes a lot out of worry, out of remorse, feeling regret about the past, feeling bad about what we've done in the past. And this is why in Buddhism it's often said it's very useful to try to live an ethical life, to live a life that doesn't harm anybody else. And so that we can come and meditate and we don't feel remorse or feel regret and worry and restless from that. Or to review our life, understand what is it that causes worry in our life, anxiety in our life. Is it because we've living unethically and we feel remorse for what we've done? Or is it because we have some value judgment about how we should be? I should be this kind of husband, I should be this kind of wife, I should be this kind of worker, I know I should be always be kind, you know, and if I should always be nice and kind and polite. Well, if you hold that kind of view about yourself, have that kind of idea, guess what? We're not always kind and polite and friendly. And so then we feel remorse about the times when we feel a bit irritated or remorse or anxious about we're not good enough. So what are the genesis? What's the source for the worry that makes us unsettled on ourselves? To be unsettled. And again, when we feel strong restlessness in meditation, it's maybe a relief to know that it's a common hindrance. It's part of the territory. It's not something to evaluate as being, oh, I'm not doing it right anymore. This is the practice to learn how to be present for it. And one of the most useful ways to be with restlessness is simply to feel it, to allow it to be there, and continue sitting with some stillness without acting on it. Just feel it and sense it. Feel it for a long time. Just be with it. Give it its freedom. Open to it and see what happens. Just be with it. Feel it in the body. Where in the body do you feel it? where exactly are these physical sensations of restlessness going around and sensing them and feeling them, being with them. And with time, they'll settle down. And you'll find yourself just feeling that, doing that exercise of being with the different physical manifestations of restlessness will begin to create the unification of the body and mind, will overcome some of the fragmentation that comes with restlessness. And then the fifth is doubt. And it's really classic. I mean, it's I think all people involved in the spiritual path sooner or later will experience doubt to varying degrees. And the doubt can be, you know, just doubt, simply doubt about the cushion. You know, should it be a cushion with velvet cover and full of water, or should it be, maybe you should do no cushion, or maybe you should get two cushions, or but you can't really be sure, and maybe you're not, you know, you try this one, it's not sure, but that works. And it can be something very mundane. It can be doubt about one's own ability to practice, one's own capacity to practice. I'm not good enough for this, so I can't do this, I'm not ready for this. It can be doubt about the practice you've chosen. You know, you doubt, well, maybe this is too bland, it's too boring, it's too simple. Maybe I should do, you know, Sufi dancing, that seems really exciting, you know, or maybe I should go off to a Gestalt camp and, you know, go down to Esalen. I'm sure if in Esalen I wouldn't be so restless if I was down there, and just, you know, or I wouldn't be so lost in thoughts about sensual gratification. You know, and so full of doubt, you know, what should I do? But Esalen, you know, maybe this and that. No, but Sufi dancing is nice, but this and that. But, you know, this Vipassana, you know, this and that about it. And what should I do? And anyway, I can't do it anyway. And who is this jerk of a teacher who's, he doesn't probably know what he's talking about anyway. And one of the classic doubts is about the teachers. You know, that the practice is great, but how can I do the practice with such a poor teacher, or someone who doesn't understand, or is confused himself, or whatever. So doubts about the teacher. Doubts about, you know, it's fine, the teacher seems okay, and I'm certainly okay, but all these people I'm sitting with, I mean, geez, what a bunch of confused bunch of people, and, you know, I'm not going to make any progress hanging out with these people. You know, maybe they're okay, but I'm not sure. You know, how am I going to know? And, you know, what should I do? And, well, maybe I'll just go home. But I don't know if I'm going home is the right thing, because then I'm giving up. And so we're lost in doubts, and we can lose ourselves in doubts for a long time. And where do the doubts arise out of? So we feel and we sense it, we allow it to be there. We don't try to close ourselves off from doubt. We don't try to close ourselves off from any of the hindrances and say they're unacceptable, but rather we open to them, to feel them carefully, and then we sometimes can understand the genesis, the source of them. Maybe the doubt comes from a deep sense of inadequacy. Maybe the doubt comes from not understanding the instructions very well, and all you need to do is go and ask a question and get it clarified. Where does it arise out of, the doubt, to understand it? Doubt often comes at the tail of the other four hindrances, because if we get very strongly plagued by the other hindrances and they're very difficult for us, that difficulty sometimes then translates into doubt. And my favorite instruction around doubt, when doubt is very, very strong and you're doubting yourself, you're doubting the practice, you're doubting everything, then you should take advantage of the power of doubt, and you should then do it more thoroughly, which means you should also doubt your doubts. You know, why do you believe everything but you're doubting? So just doubt your doubts too, and then you'll kind of maybe rest, be more at ease. Doubts tend to be cognitive. They're really, then really clearly you're kind of lost in the world of thoughts and ideas. But even there, you can feel what that spinning of the thought wheels are like physically in the body. Where do you feel energetically the concern? Is it an energized doubt? Or is it de-energizing doubt? Where do you feel the energy or the lack of energy in the body? How do you feel it? To explore it and be with it. To give in to the hindrances, especially in our daily life, I believe, just increases the tendencies in our life to be fragmented from ourselves. Because to give in to the hindrances is to give in to a lack of contact, a lack of presence in the present moment. And if we're not present for ourselves, we get pulled off in many different directions. And it can cause a tremendous amount of stress and even illnesses for us. So to come back into contact, what is it to be in touch with ourselves and the world around us? And you can't be in touch, you can't be in contact unless you're in the present moment. So what does it mean to be in the present moment? How is it to be in the present moment, to come back? And one way we cultivate this is we simply follow the breath. The breath is an extremely powerful way of honing and developing our ability to be in the present. But we don't hang on to the breath, we're not attached to it. When something else arises which is stronger than our ability to be with the breath, for example, a hindrance arises, then we want to really recognize that hindrance fully and completely, acknowledge it completely. Naming a hindrance is very helpful. Part of the power the hindrances have is that we identify with the hindrance. And in certain ways, we get caught up in it. By naming it, by labeling it, it's a way of stepping outside of the patterns of identification. And as soon as we step outside, then it loses some of its power over us. So is it a relief to hear that there's the hindrances, or maybe none of you had it visited by any of them today? And so becoming a connoisseur is recognizing these and getting to know them so that we become more familiar with them earlier when they first arise rather than after they've been around for quite a while. So it's one of the things we study when we do this practice. And what are the many different variety of ways that the hindrances manifest in our particular life. So we become the connoisseurs, we become world-class experts on how the hindrances show up in our life. So what do you think of that? Any questions or comments?
I certainly responded to when you talked about identifying the hindrance, because I even see the hindrance as a truer part of myself than whatever the aversion or desire is about.
Can you explain that then? Or give an example.
If I'm sitting here with my breath and then my back starts to hurt, somehow whether my back hurting is a more real, more who I am than whatever intention I have about breath, that sort of thing.
Oh, I see.
And it seems to me to remind myself that that's one part of who I am at the moment, that's for sure.
So if ill will arises, that when the ill will arises, that's more who you are than some idea about I'm supposed to be concentrating on the breath and the breath is where my home is or something like that.
That's right.
Yeah, that's okay. So what is it to find our home or find our stability, our presence, our composure in the midst of what's actually happening with us? And it's a difficult one because many of us feel that parts of ourselves is unacceptable. That part of me which is angry, that can't be who I am. I can't look at that. I can't be that. But that's the manifestation of our life energy right now. And so then we open to that energy. Last thing you want to do is to shut down with it. And there's a lot of wisdom that can come from opening to it. Because if we don't open to it, it comes back other ways. And causes illness, causes problems and explosions when it gets pent up too much. And there's a way in which, kind of the art of Vipassana, is we go into that which has the most energy, has the most vitality in our life, what's really going on in the present moment, and following that, following the thread of that to more and more subtlety. There are some practices of Vipassana where, there's one practice where you do this body scan, you know, Elaine, you do the body sweeping, and you kind of follow different points of the body kind of systematically. And you kind of go from kind of coarser sensations to more and more subtle sensations until you find these very, very subtle vibrative sensations after you kind of processed all the sensations in your body. In the mindfulness practice that we teach, the Vipassana practice, it's more choiceless. We don't have a systematic way of going through it. But when something arises, we bring our attention to that particular thing. And as we follow it, we go from coarser to more refined, more subtle. But it's more random how that happens. But with time, we take care of the full range of things in our life, and we find ourselves deeply connected with life itself, with ourselves. So the challenge of mindfulness is how to open up to the fullness of our being, not how to shut down different parts of ourselves so that we have some narrow idea of what it's like to be spiritual or to be concentrated or centered, but rather what is it like to open to the fullness of our being, and what is the art of that? Did you get enough for all of us?
So what I did was, I noticed, oh, okay, oh, how lucky can I be, there's a half price that but definitely noticed the pull towards that, and suddenly, all this great bread up there, I'd be very happy with this, uninteresting. So what I came to do is, I noticed that, okay, that's denier.
That's interesting. It's a good. Well, that's a good. Well, it's an interesting point. So part of it is when you go into the bakery and your senses are all completely open, and just you smell this, you have this wonderful, delightful smell of chocolate croissants and warm butter and whatever's going on in the bakery, and just really delight. And then there's the compulsion to the compulsion to get something that isn't what we really want to get. The question is, can you be open and sensitive to what's actually going on, to feel the desire and everything, and still maintain your freedom? Or do we lose our freedom? And addiction, for example, is an example. Addiction is where you lose your freedom. So if you have your freedom there at that moment, then you can decide, well, maybe I'll just get sick if I eat one more thing of sugar, and so maybe I'll avoid it today. Or maybe, it's a nice thing, I desire it, I want it, and it's a nice, cheap price, and I'm going to see all my friends, and I think I'll go get it back because it's a nice thing to do for me and for my friends. But you're doing it out of some freedom rather than out of some compulsion. So there's that possibility. That's one way. So the study of desire is, we want to go into and feel and sense that and get to know it so well, so that we're no longer compulsive in our action, but we have choice. So you can walk into the bakery and you feel the desire, you feel the compulsion, and one option you have is just go down and sit down in the chair in the bakery, in the waiting area, whatever, and just sit there with that and just kind of practice with that until all the smells and all the sights and everything you're so familiar with it all, and your movements of your mind and desire, that it's no longer compulsive, but you understand it, and then from that you can choose what to do. That's one way to practice. Another way to practice, which is what the way they did it in some Zen monasteries I was in Japan, was they called it kind of a tantric practice, but I don't know what it was. But it was kind of a... they have this, I don't know what it's called in modern psychology, they do this also, where you take what you're really addicted to, or and you eat so much of it until you get sick. Well, this is what they seem to, this seems to be a technique in a Zen monastery. And one of these had to do with alcohol. And they would just provide all this alcohol and at a certain point. And everybody got completely sick, and the last thing anybody wanted for the next 2 years was to deal with alcohol. Or noodles. They had this thing of bringing these noodles. And you're not fed very well in these monasteries. And at the end of certain practice periods, you have this little party. But I thought the party was kind of a... Anyway, they show up with these huge buckets of noodles. And it's much more than anybody, they think like horses, you know, because these big buckets of noodles. And it's all very nice, you know, the first couple of bowls, and the third bowl is kind of okay still, and the fourth bowl is getting kind of difficult. But you're expected to finish everything. You can't leave until everything's finished. And by the time everybody, you know, everybody's getting, you know, so nauseous and upset. And so there is some, maybe this is not a very good example. But the idea is sometimes it's very interesting to follow through in a very mindful way on our compulsions. And if we can do it mindfully and carefully and become familiar with the consequences, that then it becomes easier next time to know how to find our freedom in the midst of it. And that, I think, a lot of wisdom for a lot of people comes from doing something unskillful, doing it so many times until finally you get the point. Finally you're sick of it and you just simply don't want to do it again. So I don't know if this addresses your concern. Then you're not free anymore. Yeah. Every moment is a choice between freedom and lack of freedom. Go ahead, Sharon.
Okay. I get so lost in the phrase spiritual black hole. How can I incorporate that into my speaking? How can I share it with my friends? How can I put my own twist on that? But I lost, what is the spiritual black hole? Is that the hindrances?
Yeah, the hindrances.
Okay. I didn't get it.
Each hindrance is a black hole.
Okay.
So sensual desire by itself is not necessarily a black hole. But when sensual desire is a hindrance, then it's a black hole. So ill will is not the problem. The problem here, from the point of view of meditation practice, the problem in our freedom is not each thing themselves, but it's when they're strong, so strong that they become a hindrance. The literal Pali word for hindrances means in English to cover up. So when they're strong enough, they cover up our life force and our awareness. But if they don't cover it up, then it's possible still to have your freedom. And I say this, because this is a very important point for me, because there's a tendency in spiritual circles to notice something, a hindrance, notice how it hinders our spiritual life, and then attack the object, the source of it. So if there's anger can be a hindrance, and then we attack all anger. All anger becomes unacceptable. So it's not the anger that's a problem, it's the problem when we get sucked up into it and get lost.
Just get a little more about feeling it in the body. You said each one of those that you could do that, and that was helpful. Could you give an example, just expound on it a little bit? Okay, now I feel it in my stomach. Where is it going from there? Or is it just noticing it?
Well, we don't have to go anywhere, but it's noticing, and you feel it in the stomach. What does it feel like there in the stomach? So you feel it as maybe tightness. And where does that tightness, well, it feels like you explore, where is that tightness exactly? Is it deep in the stomach? Is it on the surface? How large of an area? Is there some point where it's particularly tight? And so you bring your attention to the tightest place. And what does it feel like, that tightest place? What happens when you bring your attention to it? Oh, the tightness becomes, now you know, it moves, or it changes into another sensation, or it moves and becomes something else, or something happens as you bring your attention to it. It gets bigger, it gets tighter and tighter. It dissipates, it gets looser and looser. Tightness in the stomach changes and becomes a real heavy pressure in the chest. So you go up and feel it in the chest and what's going on there. And then you feel this heavy pressure in your chest. And then you might say, well, what's the emotion with this? And so rather than being fear was what was manifesting as tightness in the stomach. But as it goes up into the chest and you feel kind of heavy pressure there, then you notice, oh, now it's sadness. So it's changed to sadness. And you stay, what does that sadness feel like? And you be with the sadness. And then maybe that dissipates, the heaviness dissipates and relaxes. And you feel kind of a warmth, looseness, relaxation in the chest. And then you say, well, what am I feeling now? Oh, now I'm feeling calm. Or maybe now I'm feeling some joy. And then you keep feeling it, to sensing it, noticing it. You don't say, oh, good, you know, I deserve it. I was with this difficult stuff, and this is really great. Now hold on to it. Rather, you kind of look at it carefully. What is this like? And we just follow the trail of sensations of experience as it develops, as it changes, as it stays the same. Not trying to change anything, not trying to make it different, but watching it as it does change. And then if it dissipates entirely and is no longer predominant, then we go back to the breath, be with the breath.
I guess I was thinking about regular life. If there's some, you know, like when you're out in the real world and you're feeling this heat come up or something, and you have to respond.
Well, you know, there's no path to answer for how to do this in daily life. You kind of use your common sense, but I find it very useful to check in kind of globally with my body periodically, what's going on there. And if I have strong sensations in my body, what's happening in the body is often a powerful way and very honest way of knowing what's going on with the rest of you, with your emotional responses. Because the body is more honest than sometimes the mind. The mind is pretty tricky.
I feel restless almost all the time.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think it's really coming from anxiety, it's just wanting to do something new and different.
Uh-huh.
And I've moved a lot, changed jobs a lot, and I'm always kind of looking forward to the next thing. But it also feels like a little driven by.
So what you can do is drop into your body and feel what that drivenness feels like. Where in your body does a drivenness reside? And then hang out with it. And if you get to know what the physical compulsive to be driven is like, maybe then you're not. It no longer becomes compulsive. That's movement, that desire for something new and being creative or whatever, no longer is a drive, but simply is a wholesome movement. But if it's a drive, a drivenness, it seems like you lost your freedom. So who knows, you know, what the restlessness comes from. But if you bring your careful attention to it and respect it and look at it carefully, sit still in the midst of it, maybe you begin understanding some of its root causes that you haven't understood yet. We never know anything, really. So we don't want to judge anything. And you simply want to open to what is here. Can I understand it better? So in your case, you know, can I understand this better? Can I open up to it? Can I find a way to be free in the midst of it? Yes.
A question about walking meditation. My version seemed like self-consciousness comes up a lot. You know, feeling, you know, I feel stupid walking around. So I'm walking a lot. I don't have any purpose. And I'm wondering, is there a technique for maybe grounding? Because I was trying the breath. I was trying counting my breath with my steps. And I was having a really hard time keeping centered.
Well, there's two general ways of answering. One is the self-centeredness. Maybe that should be useful to explore for a while, get to know it, because it's possible that what arises on retreat is just a microcosm of what happens in a normal life. So if we get, it's a wonderful chance in the silence and the intimacy to get to know something that might actually be quite common in your normal life. That's one way you could do it. The other way is actually, like you're asking, is there some way you can be able to stabilize or grounded? And if you're trying too hard and never know quite what to do and you're constantly trying different ways, it just kind of makes it more difficult. But just choose one and just kind of stay with one thing really simple and be really simple with one thing for a period of walking. One of the things that I teach is when you first go out to walk, walk in a casual way. It can be a normal speed. And establish a sense of ease in your walking. And once you found that sense of ease, then very gently and very carefully, very simply, drop down your awareness. Drop your awareness down into your legs as you walk, and feel the sensual rhythmic experience of the legs walking as you walk. And don't be too worried about it being a technique and if you're doing it right and exactly how you have to do it, but rather let yourself be carried by the walking, by the steps, and let the walking meditation walk you. Let the walking meditation meditate you rather than you meditating. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense, actually.
How do we get a copy of this tape?
Talk to Allison.
Okay, I'll help.
The question this past week, and I'm not sure words are so difficult to use anyway, but with the idea is like, where does energy come from? But the past few weeks, I have had so much energy. I've gone to the pool and worked out for an hour and swam 10 laps after that. And the world is so gorgeous and beautiful and full of abundance, and everything just seems really wonderful. Mm. You know, then the week before that, I could hardly drag myself around, and gloomy and awful. And of course, then part of the problem is I want to hang on to this, the feelings I'm having. But I had that.
It's a very good question, and it can come from a variety of different places. It can come from biological things happening certain ways. It could happen come from the weather. It can come from a natural kind of harmony within us. A natural kind of energy arises by itself. Delightful energy can come from being addicted to, or maybe being stimulated by certain things. So we're suddenly stimulated by something, and it can be many things, and that brings lots of energy. So, for example, if someone comes and praises you, you know, with lots of praise, most people will feel, you know, kind of energized from that. Wow, you know. Or someone comes along and criticizes you, and it's also energizing. And we know the manic depressive kind of swings back and forth. So energy can come from a lot of different things. And some people are addicted to mental caffeine. There's certain ways of thinking all the time, kind of thinking and thinking about themselves and the world, which energizes them and keeps them going. And one of the things that happens on retreat or in meditation is that normal caffeine of the mind quiets down, and if you don't have caffeine, haven't found our natural way of being energized. And so people spend a period of time falling asleep in meditation and being very tired or dull in meditation. So the question is excellent, and I can't give you the answer for you, but it's very interesting to spend time exploring it and understanding a little bit what happens just before the energy comes, what's fueling it, what's. And one way to do the exploration is to feel the energy carefully in meditation. And you sense it, we're in the body and feel it. And then sometimes we can feel what is generating it, what is fueling it. It might just come from a natural sense of balance, or it might come from a certain kind of excitement because, you know, you've just won this wonderful ticket for two to Mazatlan in 2 weeks. And for the next 2 weeks, you're really energized because you feel and sense it, and you feel, oh, it's coming from these thoughts about Mazatlan. Does that make sense?
So it's important to distinguish somewhat as to what the cause?
Well, the opportunity is there to distinguish. The opportunity is to explore and feel and not to take an energized way of being as for granted, and that it's only one way. I mean, some people, I think there's a tendency when we feel kind of healthily energized to think that it's just one thing, it's healthy, it's appropriate. But actually, kind of vital, kind of exciting, wonderful, joyful energy can come from many different sources, right? I mean, if someone was to buy me a wonderful Lexus, you know, I would just, you know, I would be energized for at least a couple of hours. No, it'll last me a couple of hours, probably.
I like the story about the noodles. see, but M&M's with peanuts in them, it doesn't work. Put it on the nose and get sick, and then 2 days later you want more. But, okay, so it's... Yeah, right.
So, but also, you know, enjoy your energy, but it's also enjoy it, have a nice time, but as you're enjoying it, as you're living it, one of the opportunities you have is to understand deeply, to go more deeply into your life, understand something deeper about the energy and not just take it for granted. One last thing I'll say about the hindrances, about sloth and torpor. It relates to this, and that is that there's a honeymoon period in spiritual practice, and people often get, for a while when they first learn about a practice, get all excited by it, and there's kind of like beginner's luck, and you sit down and you get, you know, concentrated and calm, and it's really wonderful, and isn't this exciting, and you're kind of energized because, you know, finally you found this spiritual practice, which is your spiritual practice, and just really exciting and wonderful and nice, and you can't wait to tell your friends, and you're really gung-ho, and isn't this really wonderful? And it's a honeymoon for a while, for a couple of days, or a couple of weeks, or a couple of years, or whatever, it varies, right, the honeymoon, how long it lasts. But sooner or later, the honeymoon phase is over, and then you have to get to work. And then, one of the responses when the honeymoon is over, is we get the energy drops and we're tired and sloth and torpor and doubt arises and it gets difficult for a while until we begin finding our bearing again and finding a more realistic way to be in relationship with our practice. So be warned if you're in your honeymoon phase. Enjoy the honeymoon. Maybe it's not nice to tell someone that, maybe it's not nice to warn someone in the middle of their honeymoon that it's only a phase. So I apologize. So maybe that's enough.